content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the January 22nd, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Obama gets an early start on shaping his legacy. What happened? President Obama struck an optimistic but combative tone in his final State of the Union address this week, arguing that his administration has made major progress on the economy and national security, and chiding Republican presidential candidates for their negativity. In a speech lacking the traditional laundry list of policy goals, Obama acknowledged his failure to bridge the partisan divide in Washington, saying it was one of his few regrets. But the president provided a strident defense of his record in office, saying, "We recovered from the worst economic crisis in generations," and touting the reform of the health care and energy sectors. In swipes against Donald Trump and other Republican presidential candidates, Obama said the fight against ISIS was being made harder by over-the-top claims that this is World War III, and warned that insulting and alienating Muslims diminishes us in the eyes of the world. He acknowledged he will leave office with unfinished business and called on Americans to address income inequality, fix our politics, and face the future with hope and optimism, not fear and anger. "The future we want is within our reach," Obama said, "but it will only happen if we work together." In the GOP's official response, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley said Obama's record fell far short of his soaring words, but she did echo his implicit criticism of Trump, warning against listening to the loudest voice in the room and turning against all immigrants. Trump himself derided the speech as boring, rambling, and non-substantive, while Senator Ted Cruz described it as less a State of the Union and more a state of denial. What the editorial said: "This speech marked the official start of Obama's legacy project," said the Wall Street Journal. "It's going to be a hard sell. While the president likes to take credit for ushering the U.S. out of recession, the economic recovery has been the slowest since World War II. Wages remain stagnant, largely because of growth inhibiting government regulation. And having pledged to change Washington's fractured politics, Obama begins his final year in office with the U.S. more divided in more ways than at any time since the 1960s. Domestically, Obama's achievements are undeniable," said USA Today. "The unemployment rate has been halved to 5%, with 14.1 million new jobs over 7 years. The American automobile industry has sprung back to life, and more Americans have health insurance than ever. But the president's critics are right to question his achievements abroad. ISIS controls large swaths of Syria and Iraq, while Russia and China have gotten away with significant and worrying territorial expansions. Obama's tactical errors, withdrawing all U.S. forces from Iraq, underestimating ISIS, have undoubtedly added to the turmoil." What the columnist said: "Perhaps he didn't fulfill the soaring hope and change rhetoric that got him elected," said Michael Grunwald in Politico.com. "But the Obama era has produced much more sweeping change than most of his supporters or detractors realize. Gays can now marry and openly serve in the military. The health industry has dramatically reformed and modernized. Carbon emissions are dropping, solar and wind energy is booming, and Obama helped forge an international agreement on climate change. Initially dismissed as a talker, our 44th president has proved to be a doer, an action-oriented policy grind. Obama has long measured his legacy against the greats, said Ron Fournier in NationalJournal.com. But his failure to heal the country's political divide, the founding promise of his political career, will hurt him in the eyes of history. Obama will be remembered as a good man and maybe a good president who nonetheless failed to be great. He made a key strategic mistake, said Jared Keller in psmag.com. In his first year in office, Obama chose to spend all his political capital on forcing through the Affordable Care Act. That battle with the GOP set a tone of partisanship and confrontation that has defined the rest of his tenure. Most of his major policies, the Iran nuclear deal in particular, can't really be judged for years or decades. But he is evidently determined to shape his legacy now, well before he has left office. This is the beginning of a long goodbye. And a second main story. El Chapo undone by movie ambitions. What happened? In the latest bizarre twist to the El Chapo saga, Mexican authorities recaptured fugitive drug lord Joaquin Guzman in a military raid last week, after the actor Sean Penn unwittingly led them to the world's most wanted criminal, Guzman, known as El Chapo or Shorty, was arrested in the western state of Sinaloa 6 months after breaking out of Altiplano Maximum Security Prison. As elite Mexican Marines stormed El Chapo's safe house and exchanged fire with his henchmen, the Sinaloa cartel leader escaped down a sewer, but was later caught in a stolen car on a nearby highway. Keen to avoid another humiliating jailbreak, Mexico's attorney general initiated the process to extradite Guzman to the U.S., where he faces drug-related indictments in several states. Mexican authorities said they tracked Guzman down after he met with Penn for a secret Rolling Stone interview in October. Penn said he was introduced to Guzman by Mexican soap star Kate del Castillo, who was helping El Chapo make a movie about his life, and spoke to the drug lord for 7 hours at his jungle hideout. Mexico said it was considering investigating the actor. In an email response, Penn wrote that he had nothing to hide. What the columnist said. The myth of El Chapo is clearly alive and well, thanks in part to fawning wannabe journalist Sean Penn, said Patrick Rodden Keefe in The New Yorker. Penn's article says nothing about the countless journalists, lawmakers, and civilians killed by Guzman, and instead paints him as a Robin Hood-style outlaw who's no more of a villain than the Americans who buy his drugs. Penn even violated journalistic ethics by giving Guzman the right to edit his finished piece, said Dara Lind in Vox.com. And his writing is pretentious, purple, and laughably bad. Penn apparently fancies himself some combination of Bob Woodward and Hunter S. Thompson. It's been clear for a long time that Poison Penn is dangerously deluded, said Ian Burrell in DailyMail.com. In his own mind, the lefty actor is a heroic aid worker, diplomat, and peacemaker, and he's ingratiated himself with all sorts of terrible men, like the Castros in Cuba and former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, as part of that moral crusade. The only thing more pathetic is that Guzman, already one of the most powerful men in the world, was willing to risk his freedom because he wants to be a film star. El Chapo could still put on a good show, said El Vulayami in TheGuardian.com. If the rumors are true, Guzman has some very good friends in high places in the U.S., many of them in financial and arms-dealing circles, and is eager to name those influential Americans in court. If Guzman makes it to the U.S. and officials don't opt for secret proceedings, we could be heading for the trial of the century. The controversy of the week, Trump, how he might lose or not. The first votes of the 2016 presidential election are less than 3 weeks away, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. And Donald Trump's bubble shows no sign of bursting. The tycoon's double-digit lead in national Republican polls, once dismissed as an ephemeral fad, is undiminished. He continues to draw huge, enthusiastic crowds everywhere. Pundits and politicians, from RNC chief Reince Priebus to Vice President Joe Biden, are now openly discussing the prospect of Trump winning the GOP nomination, and yet, most political insiders and journalists still seem to think that someone or something is going to stop him. Count me among those skeptics, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com. For all Trump's dominance in the polls, he still feels like a protest candidate. And as the Democrats' Howard Dean found out in 2004, voters tend to abandon such candidates once actual voting begins. My gut tells me that Trump will lead until he doesn't. His fall will be quick. Iowa could be Trump's Waterloo, said James Richardson in Time. Senator Ted Cruz leads Trump by a few points in that state, whose caucuses begin the primary season on February 1st. Cruz's actual margin could turn out to be larger than the polls indicate, because a great many of Trump's disaffected blue-collar supporters are only nominally tethered to the political process and generally don't vote. They're even less likely to participate in Iowa's intimidating system of caucusing, which can require a time commitment of up to 2 hours from its participants. If Cruz beats Trump handily in Iowa, said Josh Voorhees in Slate.com, it could undermine Trump's "I'm a winner because I win" pitch. The Christian conservative is also likely to win many of the evangelical and delegate-rich southern states on Super Tuesday and do equally well in the West. Donald Trump isn't going to be the Republican nominee, says Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com. He's been stuck at 25% to 35% in most primary states for months. And unless he somehow expands his support, that won't get him the 1,236 delegates required to win the nomination. After Ben Carson and Mike Huckabee drop out, Cruz will pick up their evangelical supporters. At the same time, the party will unite around one establishment candidate, either Senator Marco Rubio, Governor Chris Christie, or Jeb Bush. And that survivor will fight it out with Cruz and Trump for the nomination. That could lead to a battle on the convention floor or a victory by Cruz, the most right-wing nominee since Barry Goldwater. But the party really, really doesn't want Trump to win, and he won't. Don't be too sure of that, said Philip Bump in WashingtonPost.com. If Trump can get his angry voters to show up for the primaries, and the tens of thousands at his raucous rallies sure seem motivated, all the pundits could be wrong again. And if he becomes the GOP nominee, Trump's stature rises, and with polls showing that most Americans think the economy and the country are headed in the wrong direction, he could probably win the presidency. Some of my fellow liberals are rooting for Trump because they think his abhorrent views would doom him in the general election, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. To them, I would say, be careful what you wish for. In a general election, Trump would repackage himself for the national electorate with the same uncanny instinct for channeling voters' anger that he used to win the Republican race. Does this make Trump the favorite to win the White House? No, but this is a bad year to rule anything out. It was a good week for 40-somethings. After a new study found that the midlife crisis is not a true psychological phenomenon, and that most people are actually happier in their 40s than they were at age 18. It was a good week for color commentary after researchers discovered that people who frequently use profanity are more verbally fluent than those who don't. It's part of our emotional intelligence to know how and when to use these words, said study author Timothy Jay. And it was a good week for hanging with Hef. After the Playboy Mansion in California was listed for sale at a cool $200 million, along with a clause allowing 89-year-old Playboy Enterprises founder Hugh Hefner to continue living in the house for the rest of his life in silk pajamas. But it was a bad week for Governor Paul LePage of Maine, who blamed the state's drug problem on guys by the name D-Money, Smoothie, Shifty, who come up from New York, and half the time they impregnate a young white girl before they leave. That day, Maine officials arrested three people on heroin trafficking charges, and all were white. It was a bad week for eliminating the evidence after a suspected thief in India was forced to eat 48 bananas so that authorities could recover the stolen gold chain he had swallowed. The chain passed through the suspect's digestive tract, and its owner then put it in a plastic bag and traded it in at a jeweler for a new, cleaner one. And it was a bad week for shoplifting after a man stole a 2-foot-long python from a Portland, Oregon pet store by stuffing it down his pants. He's lucky it wasn't feeding day, said the manager. Feeding days are on Mondays, and they're very hungry. Our article on the briefing page this week is titled, Editing the Human Race. A new genetic technology called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, may enable scientists to make permanent changes in a person's DNA. What is CRISPR? It's a revolutionary gene editing technique that enables scientists to snip out a piece of any organism's DNA cheaply, quickly, and precisely, cutting and editing the code of life the way a film editor would splice an old film reel. Developed at the University of California, Berkeley in 2012, CRISPR offers great promise because it could provide a true cure for debilitating hereditary diseases such as Huntington's, muscular dystrophy, and sickle cell anemia. But it is different from traditional forms of gene therapy in one key sense. CRISPR can be used to edit genes on the human germline so that those changes are passed down through generations, permanently altering the human gene pool. That capability has given new urgency to theoretical discussions about designer babies, mutants, and scientists playing God. In December, an international group of scientists called for an immediate moratorium on inheritable human genome editing until CRISPR's risks have been assessed. Everything I've learned here says we're not ready to be doing this yet, said Nobel Prize-winning biologist David Baltimore. How does CRISPR work? The technique was adopted from certain types of bacteria that have developed a gene editing mechanism to defend against viruses. With an enzyme called CAS9 that acts like a molecular scissors, the bacteria cut out key genes of the viruses and store them so their immune system recognizes and wards off those viruses every time it encounters them. In creating CRISPR, scientists learned to use CAS9 to cut out a target gene with any cell, replace it with another gene if needed, and neatly stitch the ends of the DNA back together. The entire process takes just days, can be used to alter dozens of genes in all kinds of living organisms, and cost as little as $30. In the past, it was a student's entire PhD thesis to change one gene, said geneticist Bruce Conklin. CRISPR just knocked that out of the park. As a result, genetic research is nearing a breakthrough that could transform the world. How so? CRISPR is already being used to make certain crops invulnerable to killer fungi. And scientists have also created a strain of mosquitoes with malaria-blocking genes that the insects successfully passed on to 99.5% of their offspring. But the technique's most promising application is as a potential cure for hereditary diseases. In theory, scientists could use CRISPR to cure single gene defects like Huntington's by editing out the disease-carrying gene from the DNA of a fetus in the womb, permanently erasing the disease from the person's germline, so the offspring would also be saved. Sounds simple enough, but as a team of Chinese researchers discovered last year, modifying the actual human genome is fraught with difficulties. What happened in China? A team at Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou attempted to modify the germline in dozens of human embryos, hoping to snip out a defective gene that causes a deadly blood disorder. The study caused shockwaves in the scientific community, but also highlighted the practical difficulties of DNA editing in higher organisms. Of the 86 embryos used, all of which were non-viable, just 4 manifested the new gene designed to replace the defective one. Worse, there were inexplicable mutations in genes that weren't targeted by the researchers. The number of unintended effects is precisely why this technique is not appropriate for use in clinical applications, bioethics professor R. Altacharo told Wired. What are the scientists' biggest fears? The first is whether CRISPR can be used safely and without causing unintended genetic changes. Even the best geneticists admit that they have only scratched the surface in their understanding of the human DNA and the effects that CRISPR might have on a person's 20,000 to 25,000 genes, which interact in still mysterious ways. The larger question, of course, is whether scientists should be tinkering with the human gene pool at all. At some point, researchers could switch their attention from curing hereditary diseases to editing supposedly desirable traits into a person's DNA, such as high intelligence, tall stature, or blue eyes. Great things can be done with the power of technology, and there are things you would not want done, said Jennifer Doudna, a Berkeley biologist who co-invented CRISPR. Most of the public does not appreciate what is coming. Will there be a moratorium? That's unclear. The International Conference of Scientists, who called for the freeze in December, included authoritative figures from across the world. But they have no regulatory powers and can do nothing to stop researchers in countries like China from vigorously pursuing CRISPR experiments. Doudna says she dreads the idea of the technique being used on human embryos, but given its potential for preventing children from inheriting debilitating diseases, believes that that step is inevitable. At a recent meeting of geneticists, Doudna said, one of her colleagues observed, there may come a time when, ethically, we can't not do this. And it's time to read a few columns. We will take 2 from the U.S. The first, Europe's immigration folly. For years, conservatives on both sides of the Atlantic have warned that Europe's open-door immigration policies threaten to destabilize the continent, says Ross Douthat. The predicted cultural disaster is now underway, with the sexual assaults on hundreds of German and Finnish women by Muslim immigrants on New Year's Eve. The recent mass migration of African and Middle Eastern men to Europe, 1 million to Germany in 2015 alone, has left their host countries in uncharted territory, especially since a huge proportion of them are teenage and 20-something men without wives or families. Unattached men tend to cause trouble, and many of these men carry assumptions about women's roles that are diametrically opposed to the values of contemporary Europe. Germany and other countries cannot possibly assimilate so many immigrants at once. In fact, with its low birth rate, Germany could be headed toward a future in which half of its under 40 population consists of Islamic immigrants with profoundly illiberal views. That would be a social and political disaster and lead to a violent nativist revolt that would bring back memories of the 1930s. Germany must close its borders to immigrants and surrender the illusion that its past sins can be absolved with a reckless humanitarianism in the present. Getting rich off athletes' free labor. College sports has a racist business model, said sports lawyer Donald Yee. The two sports that bring in most of the revenue, football and basketball, are largely played by young black men. In the six biggest conferences, a 2013 study found 57% of football players and 64% of men's basketball players were African American, even though black men made up less than 3% of the overall student population. Only a tiny percentage of college athletes go on to sign NBA and NFL contracts, and many never get their diplomas because they are required to spend so much time practicing, traveling, and playing. But their free labor on the playing field generates billions of dollars for the colleges, coaches, assistants, and officials in the conferences and NCAA, who routinely make salaries ranging from $500,000 to $7 million. A recent study found that 87.5% of top-tier head football coaches and 76% of Division I basketball coaches were white. It's time for athletes to realize the huge economic power they wield and take a stand. If they refuse to play until they are paid, colleges will panic, and change could come rapidly and fairly easily. And this column from Somalia. An instinct for commerce brings stability. Thanks to the business acumen of the Somali people, Somalia is no longer a failed state, says Charles Onyago Obo. Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked group that has been battling United Nations-backed forces for years, has not been defeated, but it has been routed from major cities. Outgoing UN envoy Nicholas Kay says Somalia has stabilized and is now a recovering, fragile country. How have the Somalis managed this? By being more practical and resilient than others in their position. Elsewhere in Africa, people wait for a formal end to conflict to be declared before they will risk starting a business. Somalis, though, move in quickly and start building just days after militants have left. They are unfazed by the fact that more than 80% of the currency in circulation is counterfeit. They just accept fake shillings as legal tender and improvise an economy from there. Somalia embodies a spirited competition for the souls of the people between the benefits of war and militia membership on the one side and the profit of unregulated commerce on the other side. The lesson for Africa is that warring factions don't need to love one another to make peace. They just need to be greedy enough to want to do business. Our in-depth article this week is titled Anxious About AI. Some of the world's top scientists and philosophers believe that intelligent machines pose a threat to humanity. Journalist Joel Achenbach asked them to explain why they are so worried. The world's spookiest philosopher is Nick Bostrom, a thin, soft-spoken Swede. of all the people worried about runaway artificial intelligence, killer robots, and the possibility of a technological doomsday, Bostrom conjures the most extreme scenarios. In his mind, human extinction could be just the beginning. Bostrom's favorite apocalyptic hypothetical involves a machine that has been programmed to make paperclips, although any mundane product will do. The machine keeps getting smarter and more powerful, but never develops human values. It achieves superintelligence. It begins to convert all kinds of ordinary materials into paperclips. Eventually, it decides to turn everything on Earth, including the human race, into paperclips. Then it goes interstellar. You could have a superintelligence whose only goal is to make as many paperclips as possible. And you get this bubble of paperclips spreading through the universe, Bostrom calmly told an audience in Santa Fe earlier this year. He added, maintaining his tone of understatement, "I think that would be a low-value future." Bostrom's underlying concerns about machine intelligence, unintended consequences, and potentially malevolent computers have gone mainstream. You can't attend a technology conference these days without someone bringing up AI anxiety. It hovers over the tech conversation with the high-pitched whine of a 1950s-era Hollywood flying saucer. People will tell you that even Stephen Hawking is worried about it, and Bill Gates, and that Tesla founder Elon Musk gave $10 million for research on how to keep machine intelligence under control. All that is true. How this came about is as much a story about media relations as it is about technological change. The machines are not on the verge of taking over. This is a topic rife with speculation and perhaps a whiff of hysteria. But the discussion reflects a broader truth. We live in an age in which machine intelligence has become part of daily life. Computers fly planes and soon will drive cars. Computer algorithms anticipate our needs and decide which advertisements to show us. Machines create news stories without human intervention. Machines can recognize your face in a crowd. New technologies, including genetic engineering and nanotechnology, are cascading upon one another and converging. We don't know how this will play out, but some of the most serious thinkers on Earth worry about potential hazards and wonder whether we remain fully in control of our inventions. Science fiction pioneer Isaac Asimov anticipated these concerns when he began writing about robots in the 1940s. He developed rules for robots, the first of which was, a robot may not injure a human being or, through inaction, allow a human being to come to harm. People still talk about Asimov's rules, but they talk even more about what they call the singularity. The idea dates to at least 1965, when British mathematician and codebreaker I.J. Goode wrote, an ultra-intelligent machine could design even better machines. There would then unquestionably be an intelligence explosion, and the intelligence of man would be left far behind. In 1993, science fiction author Werner Vinge used the term the singularity to describe such a moment. Inventor and writer Ray Kurzweil ran with the idea, cranking out a series of books predicting the age of intelligent spiritual machines. Kurzweil, now a director of engineering at Google, embraces such a future. He is perhaps the most famous of the techno-utopians, for he believes that technological progress will culminate in a merger of human and machine intelligence. We all will become transhuman. Whether any of this will actually happen is a subject of robust debate. Bostrom supports the research but worries that sufficient safeguards are not in place. Imagine, he says, that human engineers programmed the machines to never harm humans, an echo of the first of Asimov's robot laws. But the machines might decide that the best way to obey the harm no humans command would be to prevent any humans from being born. or imagine, Bostrom says, that superintelligent machines are programmed to ensure that whatever they do will make humans smile. They may then decide that they should implant electrodes into the facial muscles of all people to keep us smiling. Bostrom isn't saying this will happen. These are thought experiments. His big picture idea is that just in the past couple of centuries, we've seen astonishing changes in the human population and economic prosperity. In Bostrom's view, our modern existence is an anomaly, one created largely by technology. Our tools have suddenly overwhelmed the restrictions of nature. We're in charge now, or seem to be, but what if the technology bites back? There is a second Swede in this story, and even more than Bostrom, he's the person driving the conversation. His name is Max Tegmark. He's a charismatic 48-year-old professor in the physics department at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's also a founder of something called Future of Life Institute, which has been doling out Elon Musk's money for research on making AI safer. Tegmark is something of a physics radical, the kind of scientist who thinks there may be other universes in which not only the speed of light and gravity are different, but also the mathematical underpinnings of reality. Tegmark and Bostrom are intellectual allies. The future is ours to shape, Tegmark said. I feel we are in a race that we need to win. It's a race between the growing power of the technology and the growing wisdom we need to manage it. Right now, almost all the resources tend to go into growing the power of the tech. In April 2014, 33 people gathered in Tegmark's home to discuss existential threats from technology. They decided to form the Future of Life Institute. It would have no paid staff members. Tegmark persuaded numerous luminaries in the worlds of science, technology, and entertainment to add their names to the cause. Skype founder Jean Tallien signed as a co-founder. Actors Morgan Freeman and Alan Alda joined the governing board. Tegmark put together an op-ed about the potential dangers of machine intelligence, lining up three illustrious co-authors: Nobel laureate physicist Frank Wilczek, artificial intelligence researcher Stuart Russell, and the biggest name in science, Stephen Hawking. The piece was a brief, breezy tract that included a dismayed conclusion that experts weren't taking the threat of runaway AI seriously. AI, the authors wrote, is potentially the best or worst thing ever to happen to humanity. CNBC declared, "Artificial intelligence could end mankind." Hawking. That got everyone's attention. Just down the street from Tegmark's office is MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab, where robots are aplenty. Director Daniela Russ is an inventor who just nabbed $25 million from Toyota to develop a car that will never be involved in a collision. Is she worried about the singularity? It rarely comes up, Russ said. It's just not something I think about. With a few exceptions, most full-time AI researchers think the Bostrom-Tegmark fears are premature. A widely repeated observation is that this is like worrying about overpopulation on Mars. Russ points out that robots are better than humans at crunching numbers and lifting heavy loads, but humans are still better at fine, agile motions, not to mention creative, abstract thinking. She makes a point about self-driving cars. They can't drive just anywhere. They need precise maps and predictable situations. Self-driving cars struggle with heavy traffic, she said, and even rain and snow are a problem. Imagine them trying to understand hand gestures from other drivers. There's too much going on, Russ said. The future is implacably murky when it comes to technology. The smartest people on the planet fail to see what's coming. For example, many of the great sages of the modern era didn't anticipate that computers would get smaller rather than bigger. And anyone looking for something to worry about in the near future might want to consider the opposite of superintelligence, super stupidity. In our increasingly technological society, we rely on complex systems that are vulnerable to failure in complex and unpredictable ways. Deep water oil wells can blow out and take months to be resealed. Nuclear power reactors can melt down. How might intelligent machines fail, and how catastrophic might those failures be? Often there is no one person who understands exactly how these systems work or are operating at any given moment. Throw in elements of autonomy, and things can go wrong quickly and disastrously. Such was the case with the flash crash in the stock market in 2010 when, in part because of automated ultra-fast trading programs, the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped almost 1,000 points within minutes before rebounding. What we're doing every day today is producing super stupid entities that make mistakes, argues Boris Katz, another artificial intelligence researcher at MIT. Machines are dangerous because we are giving them too much power, and we give them power to act in response to sensory input. But these rules are not fully thought through. And then sometimes the machine will act in the wrong way, he said, but not because it wants to kill you. I actually think it would be a huge tragedy if machine superintelligence were never developed, Bostrom said. That would be a failure mode for our Earth-originating intelligent civilization. In his view, we have a chance to go galactic, or even intergalactic, with our intelligence. Bostrom, like Tegmark, is keenly aware that human intelligence occupies a minuscule space in the grand scheme of things. Earth is a small rock orbiting an ordinary star on one of the spiral arms of a galaxy with hundreds of billions of stars, and at least tens of billions of galaxies twirl across the known universe. Artificial intelligence, Bostrom said, is the technology that unlocks this much larger space of possibilities, of capabilities, that enables unlimited space colonization, that enables uploading of human minds into computers, that enables intergalactic civilizations with planetary-sized minds living for billions of years. There's a bizarre wrinkle in Bostrom's thinking. He believes a superior civilization would possess essentially infinite computing power. These superintelligent machines could do almost anything, even create simulated universes that include programs that precisely mimicked human consciousness, replete with memories of a person's history, even though all this would be entirely manufactured by software, with no real-world physical manifestation. Bostrom goes so far as to say that unless we rule out the possibility that a machine could create a simulation of a human existence, we should assume that it is overwhelmingly likely that we are living in such a simulation. I'm not sure that I'm not already in a machine, he said calmly. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And a rather lengthy obituary for you this week. The musical chameleon who never stopped changing. David Bowie, 1947 to 2016. David Bowie was a master of reinvention. Over a five-decade career, the genre-spanning British artist blazed a trail in everything from glam rock to soul, new wave to electronica, changing his entire look and style with each musical shift. In the early 1970s, he performed as Ziggy Stardust, an intergalactic glam rock star visiting a doomed planet Earth. Later, he became the Thin White Duke, a cocaine-addled Third Reich-obsessed aristocrat who sang torch songs. Yet Bowie's many alter egos, studiously mimicked by his legions of fans, weren't just an expression of his unrivaled creativity. They were also a means of hiding his natural shyness. "I didn't really have the nerve to sing my songs on stage," he said. "I decided to do them in disguise so that I didn't have to actually grow through the humiliation of going on stage and being myself." Bowie, who died this week at age 69 after an 18-month battle with cancer, was born David Jones in Brighton, a working-class South Bronx or South London neighborhood scarred by World War II bombs, said the Washington Post. His older half-brother, Terry, introduced him to jazz, and in 1961 his mother bought him his first instrument, a plastic saxophone. A punch to the eye during a schoolyard scrap the following year left him with a permanently dilated left pupil, a minor deformity that would add to the otherworldly appearance he would later cultivate. At 15, he began playing sax and guitar in local bands and found he enjoyed singing as well as the attention of female fans. To avoid being confused with Davy Jones of the Monkees, he changed his last name to Bowie after the 19th century American frontiersman. After a brief spell studying theater and mime, and a debut album that sank without a trace, Bowie had his first hit with 1969's Space Oddity, a song about an astronaut who decides to stay sitting in my tin can far above the world rather than return to Earth. Released 5 days before the Apollo 11 launch, it reached number 5 in Britain. The following year was a momentous one for Bowie, said The Guardian. His brother Terry was committed to a psychiatric institution. He would commit suicide in 1985, and Bowie married his art student girlfriend, Angela Barnett. Artistically, Bowie was powering ahead. He released The Man Who Sold the World, a broody hard rock LP in 1970, with its explorations of insanity, immortality, and mysticism. It was the first album to do full justice to his writing and performing gifts. The singer quickly followed with Hunky Dory, a mix of anthemic pop and elaborate songwriting. It met with only moderate success, but his next release, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, transformed him into a superstar. He promoted this album with provocative media appearances, telling one interviewer he was gay. He later said he was bisexual, and still later described himself as a closeted heterosexual, and performed live as Ziggy, an androgynous alien with orange hair and elaborate makeup. Fans reacted with enthusiasm unseen since Beatlemania. But following the release of 1973's Aladdin Sane, Bowie's first UK number one album, he abruptly changed direction and retired the Ziggy Stardust character. "My policy has been that as soon as a system or process works, it's out of date," he later explained. "I move on to another area." Bowie relocated to the U.S. and melodramatically announced that rock music was dead, said the Times. He embraced black dance music on 1974's Young Americans, which gave him a U.S. number one single, Fame, and reinvented himself as the Thin White Duke on 1976's Station to Station. While managers, middlemen, and record companies grew rich on his success, Bowie himself was close to bankruptcy. He had signed record contracts early in his career that he hadn't read carefully and fought a long legal battle to shake off the leeches. Eager to clean up his financial affairs and kick a cocaine habit that had grown astronomic, Bowie later recalled how he once blew his nose and half of my brain fell out. He left America in the late 70s to take up residence in tax-friendly Switzerland. The change of view was a catalyst for another of Bowie's great leaps forward. Working with ambient music pioneer Brian Eno and recording in Berlin, he came up with a trilogy of dark, densely synthesized albums in Low, Heroes, and Lodger. "A new decade brought another new start," said the Daily Telegraph. He divorced Angela in 1980, their hedonistic, promiscuous lifestyle having long since wrecked their relationship, and in 1983 transformed into a stadium-filling pop star with the album Let's Dance, which sold more than 2 million copies worldwide. but its success depressed Bowie. I suddenly felt very apart from my audience, he said. I didn't know what they wanted. So with his financial future secure, Bowie set off in new directions. Having played an emaciated alien in the 1976 film The Man Who Fell to Earth, he expanded his range as an actor, appearing as a goblin king in the fantasy film Labyrinth, 1986, Pontius Pilate in The Last Temptation of Christ, 1988, and Andy Warhol in Basquiat, 1996. After getting married for a second time to Somali-born model Iman Abdulmajid, he mellowed into an affable, discursive teetotaler. By the 21st century, Bowie was an elder statesman, said the New York Times. He had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and sang at the concert for New York City 6 weeks after the 9/11 attacks. He dramatically scaled back his touring activities after developing heart problems in 2004, but continued to lend his imprimatur to newer bands like Arcade Fire. In 2013, Bowie unexpectedly released The Next Day, his first new album in a decade, to great acclaim. His 25th and final album, the jazzy electronic-infused Black Star, came out just 2 days before his death. The video for the single, Lazarus, shows the musician in a hospital bed and ends up with him retreating into a coffin-like closet. Look up here, the lyrics begin. I'm in heaven. Here on the health and science page, we have the most powerful El Nino ever. The weather phenomenon known as El Nino has already wreaked havoc around the globe, triggering widespread drought, flooding, and other disasters. But NASA meteorologists warn that the worst is yet to come. New satellite images suggest the current system may surpass the strongest ever recorded, which in the winter of 1997-98 claimed an estimated 23,000 lives worldwide. Dubbed with a Spanish term for the baby Jesus, because it usually gathers steam around Christmas, El Nino occurs when cooling trade winds weaken or reverse direction, allowing the tropical Pacific Ocean to grow unusually warm. The warm ocean pumps heat and moisture into the atmosphere, altering the storm track over North America and other parts of the world. This year's El Nino has triggered deadly storms across the southern U.S., much higher than average temperatures in the Midwest and Northwest, and torrential rains and deep snow in the West. Colder temperatures have temporarily returned in much of the country, but the long parched West Coast, which desperately needs to refill reservoirs and groundwater, will continue to get too much rain too fast, with resulting flash floods and mudslides. The water story for much of the American West over the most of the past decade has been dominated by punishing drought, NASA climatologist Bill Patzert tells TechTimes.com. Now we're preparing to see the flip side of nature's water cycle, the arrival of steady, heavy rains and snowfall. On the Talking Points page, Flint, the poisoning of a city. Nearly 2 years ago, Michigan officials decided to save money by switching the city of Flint's water supply from Lake Huron to the Flint River, said Sarah Ganem in CNN.com. Soon after the switch, the water started to look, smell, and taste funny. Children in the largely poor and black city began developing rashes and losing their hair. Republican Governor Rick Snyder and city officials reassured residents that the murky brown drinking water was safe. But then one doctor began analyzing kids' blood lead levels and found that they had doubled and even tripled in just months. After ignoring residents' concerns for 18 months, said Elias Isquith in Salon.com, officials came clean. The Flint River water was high in chloride, possibly from road salt runoff, and therefore extremely corrosive. It had been causing the city's old water pipes to leach lead, poisoning residents with one of the most damaging neurotoxins known to science. This story is horrifying on a visceral, this isn't supposed to happen here level, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. In 2013, Snyder appointed an emergency manager to fix the broken city of Flint, which lost its economic base when factories closed. That manager, unaccountable to voters, decided to save some money by making them drink the famously filthy Flint River. The state even chose not to spend a paltry $100 a day to treat the river water to make it less corrosive, said the Detroit Free Press in an editorial. Meanwhile, Snyder has moved with infuriating slowness in admitting something was wrong, and then in distributing water filters and bottled water and testing residents for lead exposure. One has to wonder, how would the state have responded to a crisis of such proportions in a community with more wealth and power? To allow lead of all toxins into drinking water is a moral atrocity, said Ryan Cooper in TheWeek.com. Lead stunts children's growth and causes irreversible brain damage. Its debilitating effects on IQ levels and impulse control may have caused a great crime wave in the 1960s and 70s. That's how lead works, said Yinan Wang in the Washington Post. It leaves its mark quietly with a virtually invisible trail that causes decades of suffering. In years to come, countless Flint parents will wonder if their kids' lives would have been better if it weren't for the water. One quick poll watch item. After years of bitter partisanship, just 29% of Americans identify as Democrats and 26% as Republicans. 42% identify as independents. And we'll finish with a quote from G.K. Chesterton. He says, "All theology has two simple principles, that we matter and that everyone else matters." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.